These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. They are produced by the Teaching Company. These lectures are titled The Italian Renaissance, Part 3. Lecture 25, The Crisis, The French Invasion of 1494.
In previous lectures, we've alluded to the events of the French invasions of 1494, particularly when we discussed in Milan the desire of Lodovico Sforza to maintain his rule and the circumstances that gave rise to his welcoming the French. But we also must note that these invasions of 1494 represented amongst the most cataclysmic moments in all Italian history, began a period that would ultimately end in the subjection of the peninsula for over 350 years to foreign rulers. It was also the crisis of the Italian Renaissance. It was the moment when all of the values that we've been investigating were challenged by forces from without, forces that the Italians themselves were really unable to sustain. As you'll recall, the Peace of Lodi of 1454 and the Italian League, which followed the subsequent year, which were negotiated between Cosimo de' Medici and Francesco Sforza, created a period of remarkable peace in the Italian peninsula. Italy began to see a period of at least the serious reduction of the endemic warfare that had characterized Italian life. The League allowed for collective security. It allowed for an opportunity for the five major states of the peninsula to work together in order to limit war and also to provide a kind of collective security against external aggression. And in many ways, it worked. There were also other factors that allowed Italy to develop independently. Things, again, outside of Italian control, but which benefited the Italians so greatly that the Renaissance could take place. Things that had economic implications, but for the moment of this lecture, things that had very, very significant political and military implications as well. First of all, the great dynastic monarchies north of the Alps were themselves divided. The feudal kingdoms of France and the Iberian Peninsula hadn't yet coalesced into powerful centralized states. But that was beginning to change, especially in the second half of the 15th century. France became a centralized territorial monarchy under Louis XI, known appropriately as the Spider, who died in 1483. And this was the consequence of the end of the Hundred Years' War, in part, when the French kings could concentrate on building their own power internally, as opposed to trying to keep the English out. The Iberian Peninsula, at about the same time, was coming together as a result of a dynastic union. The kingdoms of the Iberian Peninsula, that is, that territory that contains Spain and Portugal and the remnants of the Moorish kingdoms in Europe, the Iberian Peninsula came together as a result of the marriage of Isabel of Castile and Ferdinand of Aragon. This united, then, all of the Spanish-speaking territories into a single state. And the intention was not just to create this dynastic union, which ultimately would give rise to the Kingdom of Spain, but also to use this as a foundation for the driving of the Moors, that is, the Islamic kingdoms, from Granada, and also, ultimately, the expulsion of the Jews, both of which took place in 1492. The Holy Roman Empire, that is, the German-speaking lands on the other side of the Rhine, remained weak. The Holy Roman Emperor was, after all, an elective office. The power base of each individual emperor depended almost completely on the degree to which the electing princes and the other princes of Germany would provide support. Consequently, in the 15th century, there was a sense of weakness without a sense of general purpose to the empire. But all of these things changed. First of all, there was that other event of the second half of the 15th century that changed European history so dramatically and for such a long time. In 1453, the Turks under Mohammed the Conqueror took the city of Constantinople, the capital of the Byzantine Empire. That empire founded by the Emperor Constantine, that empire which was a continued unbroken succession of emperors from the time of the first Christian Emperor of Rome, fell to the Turks. Seen in Europe as the infidel. The effect of this, then, was not only psychological, but it was also military and economic. In particular, it meant that the luxury trade, largely managed by the Venetians with huge profit, was challenged. And in fact, that Venetian monopoly, that Italian monopoly on long-distance luxury trade, evaporated. The Turks had no interest in sustaining the benefits that the Venetians had received after the Fourth Crusade. To them, all of the Italians, all Christians, were merely infidels to pay higher taxes, bribes, and fees. Also, the victory of the Muslims in the Eastern Mediterranean resulted in constant warfare. As the Turks began to expand into the Aegean, into the Mediterranean, and then ultimately into Europe itself, there was need for constant warfare. The previously safe harbors, the protected trade routes, were then gone. The Venetians and the other Italians then had to turn their trading galleys into war galleys, and the amount of trade was limited. It became much more expensive and dangerous, and it naturally declined. The effect of this on Italy was also felt through forces, again, outside of Italian control. It was clear to the Portuguese that there had to be another way around the continent of Africa in order to get to the rich cities of the East. If the Mediterranean had become too expensive and too dangerous to trade in with any kind of security and comfort, then perhaps there was an end to the African continent. Then maybe what the Romans did not know could be proved by the contemporary Portuguese, who every year went a little bit farther down the coast of that continent until ultimately Vasco da Gama sailed around it, proving not only that it had an end, but also that you could sail from the cities of the Atlantic seaboard, from the cities of Portugal and Spain, and later from the cities of Holland and England and France, and reach the rich trading cities of the East, of India, and ultimately China. The result was that the monopoly that the Italians had enjoyed in the Mediterranean ended. No longer was the Mediterranean Sea the media terra, the center of the earth, as it had been almost from anthropological times. Now for Europe, the new center of economic authority was the Atlantic seaboard, where ships could be loaded and sail directly to the East and return full of rich treasure. This began the decline of Italy economically, a decline that ultimately, by the 17th century, would turn Italy into an economic backwater, just looking at its past glory with nostalgia. Similarly, the end of the Hundred Years' War had an enormous effect on Italy. First of all, it meant that the dynastic kingdoms could unite. Secondly, it meant that the French and the English were no longer in need of huge amounts of money borrowed from Italian bankers to fight their continuous wars. The Italian bankers suffered, and consequently the Italian economy suffered, with less and less of the accumulated wealth of Europe being funneled into their coffers. Equally, the coming of peace, especially to the Low Countries, meant that their indigenous woolen industry, those great cities like Ypres that had produced high-quality woolen cloth, could now once more challenge the Florentines. This cloth, so much more easily available, costing less to transport, could then clothe the rich merchants and nobles of the north. The Italian industry, especially that of Florence then, began to suffer as well. Much of this came to a head in the personality of a very, very curious young man, the young, extremely ambitious, delusional Charles VIII of France. From the time he reached his age of majority, this young king believed that he had a divine mission. He believed that he was the figure that was going to ultimately put together a great crusade and drive the infidel from the Holy Lands, defeat the Turks, unite the world under a single Christian monarch, who, of course, would be Charles. He also believed that the first stage was to undo one of the misfortunes of history, and that is keeping his family away from the crown of Naples. He believed that the crown of Naples was his by dynastic right and that it had been usurped, and it was his intent to undo this terrible event that took place as a consequence of the madness of Queen Joanna of Naples and thereby make history right once more so his crusade could begin. The House of Aragon, which, of course, co-ruled the Iberian Peninsula with the House of Castile as a result of the marriage of Ferdinand and Isabella, had not only claims on Sicily and Naples, but also on the Duchy of Milan. It was also this kingdom of Spain, as it was becoming, rich and zealous battle-hardened soldiers. Those soldiers who had fought in the reconquest of the Iberian Peninsula, who had fought on the Crusades against the Moors. These professional, very experienced soldiers were in fact a danger to any force that controlled them, and the King of Spain realized the best thing to do was have them fight outside his kingdom, someone else, rather than fight within the kingdom, fighting him. Spain then would necessarily be a force that would challenge French hegemony. The Kingdom of France, one of the largest, most centralized, richest in natural resources, most fertile, was clearly a force to be reckoned with. The Spanish, though, were beginning to realize that they had conflicting claims and conflicting rights, and these would be fought out in Italy. Moreover, within the Italian states themselves, there were problems that gave rise to this kind of crisis. In 1492, Lorenzo de' Medici died. Lorenzo, the grandson of Cosimo, was very much a proponent of the Peace of Lodi, of the Italian League. He helped to make it work through his personal, skillful diplomacy. When he died, he left the rule of the city to his eldest, totally incompetent son, Piero. Piero was no match for the forces at work. He was no match internally for the ascetic Dominican monk, Girolamo Savonarola, about whom we will hear much in the next two lectures. Savonarola polarized Florence, and those that were opposed to the Medici were the supporters of the monk. There also, as a result of the preaching of this apocalyptic Dominican, a sense of fatalism that began to almost engulf the Florentine people. There was a sense that something terrible was about to happen, and they had little control over it. The mood then of Florence was not one of standing firm, but rather of fear. Savonarola, the millennial preacher, believed then that the judgment of God was at hand, and it was a judgment that would necessarily be harsh. The Florentines needed to recognize this, and the Florentines needed to repent, when in fact the Florentines needed to be decisive and fight. Savonarola, moreover, worked on the old Italian prophetic tradition. There was in Italy from the Middle Ages a long history of prophecies about foreigners who would come and cleanse the church and restore God's intent for man. Joachim of Fiora, those in the Franciscan movement who prophesied a new need to cleanse man of sin. All of these prophecies Savonarola knew and used brilliantly. And this too sapped some of the energy and also made in his reading of the book of Daniel, for example, the belief that the final seals were about to be opened, that the apocalypse was in fact at hand. In Rome, there was another crisis. The death of Pope Innocent VIII, at the same time almost as that of Lorenzo de' Medici, took away an Irenic pope. Innocent was not a person of high moral standard, to say the least, but he had been peaceful, and he wanted peace and quiet. He had married his son to one of the daughters of Lorenzo de' Medici, and there was then a sense of shared responsibility for the peace of the peninsula. Innocent worked hard then to ensure that there would be nothing that would interrupt his enjoyment of the papacy. The result was stability. Elected in his place, though, was someone of a very different personality and a different set of ambitions, Rodrigo Borgia, who became Pope Alexander VI. The Borgia intention from the beginning was to establish a Borgia kingdom using as a base the states of the church. Their ambitions were huge. The intention then was to use the papacy as an instrument for Borgia aggression. The idea of peace really wasn't part of it. Alexander, moreover, would do anything to achieve his goal, and he was even willing to compromise with foreign powers in the north in order to ensure that the Borgias would rule something in Italy while he was still pope. The Borgia campaigns then in many ways exploded the Peace of Lodi and brought a deep vein of instability and danger back into Italian diplomacy and politics. All of this reached a head, that moment of crisis, in 1494, when King Ferrante of Naples died, leaving the crown to his extremely ambitious, energetic son, Alfonso. The House of Aragon had already succeeded in separating Sicily from Naples, and the situation of the dynasty in the peninsula was very much challenged by the circumstances, as we've seen, of Lodovico il Moro as regent of Milan. Lodovico il Moro had married Beatrice d'Este, and they had produced a son. And, as I said earlier, the danger was that if the real duke, Gian Galeazzo II Sforza, should ever achieve rule, then, in fact, the danger to Lodovico and his family would be extreme. Moreover, Gianghelletto II was married to the sister of Alfonso, and consequently, the Neapolitans had a direct interest in overthrowing Lodovico's regency and establishing Gianghelletto II as the reigning Duke of Milan. Something then had to be done, and as we've seen, Lodovico very cleverly manipulated the situation so that the French would not only be invited into the peninsula to claim the Kingdom of Naples, thereby helping secure Lodovico's rule, but also would do so at the with the cooperation of the Milanese. The crown of Naples then was offered in effect to Charles by the Milanese, and Charles, that delusional young man who truly believed that he was God's instrument in the new Charlemagne, crossed the Alps to claim it. When Charles VIII of France crossed the Alps in 1494, he led the largest army to enter Italy since the barbarian invasions of the 5th century. Moreover, it was an army the like of which the Italians had not seen, arrayed with differentiated weapons, bringing mobile field artillery, cannons mounted on wheels, huge in numbers. These were not the sorts of armies that the Italians had been experienced to fight. What they saw then was a national, dynastic, feudal army confronting the mercenary forces, those tiny, highly professional groups of mercenary soldiers that fought the Italian wars. There was no contest. There couldn't be. There was no way the Italians could stand up to the French. The Milanese, as we've seen, helped pay for Charles's expedition and welcomed him. The Venetians couldn't do anything because they were busy fighting the Turks. Florence, under the foolish leadership of Piero de' Medici, simply wanted peace, wanted some kind of security, and Piero, in his own delusion, believed he had his father's diplomatic skills, went to Charles and tried to broker a deal in which Florence would end up ahead. Instead, he achieved only total humiliation, an arrangement through which Florence lost its port of Pisa at the head of the Arno, a city that Florence had fought so hard to achieve, a city that was necessary for Florentine long-distance trade and access to the sea. Also, Florence gave up the fortresses on the perimeter of its territory, fortresses like Sarzana that were built in order to protect the territory of the Florentine people, were now turned over to French garrisons. The Pope, Alexander VI, was interested only in his family ambitions, and he was willing to bargain away Italian liberty and freedom to further those things. So when the French army entered Italy, Naples, in fact, already had its fate sealed. There was nothing that could, in fact, stop the French. In 1495, Naples capitulated. Charles entered the city as a conqueror, claimed its crown, and spent his time enjoying his victory. With Naples captured, France then had to find a way of keeping the kingdom, of trying to neutralize the forces that were then coalescing around the opposition, recognizing how dangerous this moment had become. Initially, these were events that seemed to be driven by a kind of mad logic. Everything seemed to be working in its favor. But as soon as the ease of the victory of Charles VIII was known, not only in Italy, but in the rest of Europe, a great sense of fear, a sense of unease about the future began to inhabit the capitals of the continent. Everything was too easy. Charles' advance was too easy. It was more like a military parade than a military campaign. And Charles knew that he ultimately would have to leave Naples and return to his own kingdom, which he began in 1495. In the intervening months, though, that sense of unease, that general recognition of the serious danger that this circumstance had given rise to, galvanized the other kings and princes of Italy and Europe to do something. It became clear then that the French extinction of Aragonese claims in Naples was a great danger to the empire, for example, and a great danger to the dynastically united Spanish peninsula. It would be easy then for France to attack the empire, for example, on two fronts, from below and also from the west. It was also clear then that the same circumstance could arise in the Spanish peninsula. France had to be humbled. France had to be controlled. Moreover, Lodovico il Moro very, very quickly saw the danger of his desperate gamble. He realized what a mistake it had been, because he also knew perfectly well that the Royal House of France had legitimate dynastic claims on the Duchy of Milan. He knew very well that he was seen as, in some ways, a usurper. He was seen as someone who owed his crown to the emperor. The French then would have no compunction whatsoever of doing what they had done to the Florentines, essentially treacherously abandon their interests and take advantage of the circumstances and give rise to a new sense of French hegemony on the continent. Lodovico then joined the opposition. He helped harry Charles VIII and his army out of Italy, and in fact, the Milanese were largely responsible for the one inconclusive battle, that at Fornovo, which technically the Italian forces won, but really was a kind of draw. In the end, Charles lost control of Naples. It was too far. His supply lines were too long. He had too many enemies in between. But it was very clear that a new order, in fact, had been created as a result of his military experiment. The Aragonese reclaimed the Kingdom of Naples, and they were determined that they weren't going to give it up. Something, in fact, had to be done, and the Italians knew it. They began to think amongst themselves about how to achieve some form of protection. But the days of the Peace of Lodi, the days of Francesco Sforza and Lorenzo de' Medici and Cosimo de' Medici were long past. A time when the states could work together for common purpose had passed. What was seen now was a new world, one in which individual self-interest on the part of Italian princes began to play a desperate role in trying to further their interests at the expense of those of their neighbors. The Borgia Pope had clear ambitions. Piero de' Medici had his own, and he was on top of that, stupid, foolish, and incompetent. He had bargained away the goodwill that his father had established, and now he was left in the situation of being allied to the kingdom that threatened his rule the most. The same was true with the Milanese. Lodovico il Moro still ruled a brilliant court, but he also ruled it in fear, knowing that the next French invasion could very well be directed at Milan as well as Naples. Charles then had succeeded in completely and totally fragmenting the Italian peninsula, politically, militarily, and even kind of psychologically. The Italians then stopped thinking the way that they had after the Peace of Lodi, being able to consider themselves Italians. They now saw themselves rather as desperate Florentines, desperate Milanese, the papal ambitious ruler of the Holy See, or the desperately nervous King of Naples. Also, it was clear to anyone who watched that this promenade militaire over the Alps, that easy victory that Charles VIII had achieved, meant that the entire Italian peninsula, with its incredibly rich prizes, its concentrated wealth, its wonderful cities, its art, all of these things were available for the taking. Whoever had the ability to cross those mountains and simply march and claim some form of victory over the disunited states of the peninsula could, in fact, take whatever he wanted. The death of Charles VIII, as we've seen in 1498, focused much of this fear in another way. Charles, as I said, was an extraordinarily improbable conqueror. He was small, top-heavy, not completely capable of closing his mouth, foolish-looking, in fact, the object of some ridicule when he wasn't watching. The means of his death reflected this. He was scurrying along a parapet at his chateau at Blois. He saw a tennis match in one of the courtyards below, captured his interest and attention, stared at it intently while he continued to scurry along the parapet, didn't notice a very low lintel, hit his head, and knocked his brains out and died. His death at the age of 28, without any legitimate issue, focused the crisis because it turned the crown of France to his cousin. His cousin was the Duke of Anjou, who then took the regnal title of Louis XII. The Duke of Anjou was the grandson of a daughter of Giangaleazzo Visconti. Earlier I said that one of the dangers of the Milanese and the attempt to create some form of dynastic equality with the great powers of the North was to marry their daughters to their sons. The marriage of the children of Gian Galeazzo Visconti into the royal house of France resulted in a direct claim through the Visconti line of the House of Anjou to Milan. This, of course, Louis XII saw with delight. He saw the opportunity, and he had every intention of acting on it. Louis XII was a very different kind of ruler from Charles VIII. Louis was an extremely careful, organized, brilliant king. He knew that if he was going to maintain his singular rule of his rather fractious dynastic monarchy, if he was going to succeed in maintaining it united and centralized, what he had to do was keep his fractious and violent feudal nobles fighting elsewhere. And his decision was for them to fight in Italy. It didn't take much for Louis to claim Milan. We've seen from the perspective of Lodovico il Moro and Beatrice d'Este the tragic events that gave rise to the French conquest of the duchy and the terrible effect that it had on not only Lodovico himself and on his son, but also on Italian history altogether. When that campaign of 1500 began, it began the way Charles VIII had, an enormous feudal army with the kinds of weapons and organization the Italians couldn't imagine assembling, marching into the Italian peninsula across the flat Lombard plain towards the great city of St. Ambrose. Its fall and the ultimate capture of Lodovico il Moro and the establishment of a French rule in Milan would have disastrous effects. First of all, it meant that the French would have a power base within Italy, one that they could use in order to challenge the Aragonese in Naples, because the French continued to claim that crown of Naples. The circumstance, then, is that Italy was not just fragmented amongst the various states of the peninsula, but there was superimposed a division of two great northern dynastic powers, that of Aragon in the south and that of France in the north. Their wars would bring in all of the Italian states, devastate the peninsula, and cause 60 years of the most terrible bloodshed the peninsula had seen. It was a situation that then became intolerable, because there was nothing the Italians could do. It began a period of not just fragmentation, but a period of internecine and civil war, a time when each of the Italian states tried in their own way to confront what all of them called the barbarians. It's not an accident that Machiavelli and his prince, and almost every other writer that was Machiavelli's contemporary, called the French and the Spanish and the Imperials barbarians. They saw them as the heirs of those same tribes that had destroyed Rome. They saw the effect that these invasions had on the Roman Empire, and they feared the same effect at their own time. The result, then, Italy began a decline, fragmentation, indeed disintegration. What we will look at now is the effects that gave rise to not just that tragic moment which would result in Italy being ruled by foreigners for the next 350 years and more until the Risorgimento of the second half of the 19th century. Not just the loss of Italian liberty, but also the terrible events in each of the Italian states as each one tried to confront and deal with and ultimately try to solve this crisis. And of course, they couldn't. Machiavelli, as we'll see, was quite right when he said the great failure of the Italians was the inability to work together against a common enemy. They rather, in fact, fought the enemies they knew. Those enemies were often inside their own walls, as we'll see next lecture with Savonarola and the opposing factions. Occasionally amongst their own fellow Italians, as in the issues between the various Italian states. Similarly, we see that in this period of crisis on the peninsula, the larger period of crisis of the Turkish expansion, the threat to Christianity altogether that the Turks caused with their invasion of the heartland of Europe from the Balkans in the 16th century. All of this then came to a kind of focus into a time of crisis. When Savonarola said the last days were at hand and prophesied the end of the world and the second coming, it was easy then for people to believe him. They simply had to look about, and there seemed to be evidence everywhere. Savonarola seemed to be simply saying what everybody saw to be true. The seventh seal was about to be opened, and the period of Armageddon had begun.